Well, we are continuing our study of the Gospel of John, and we have gone through most of the first 10 chapters, but we have just a few verses left in John chapter 10 and that are sort of a transition and lead into John chapter 11. So what we have noticed is that the last few chapters of John's Gospel have recorded many occasions of resistance and resistance to and rejection of Jesus. But yet there have been some glimpses of some positive response mixed in as well. And in general, there has been more acceptance of Jesus away from Jerusalem than in Jerusalem. Now, you would think that Jerusalem being the center of the religious detail of Israel, that it would be the most accepting of their Messiah. However, it was just the opposite. It's kind of an interesting thing to observe. But we will see in this chapter again this matter of greater acceptance of those outside of Jerusalem than in. So this chapter also contains some significant and familiar drama regarding the death of a loved one. And it's probably very familiar. John chapter 11 gives us this familiar account of dealing with the tragedy of death and how it impacts the people around the situation. But it also includes great hope that Christ brings when facing the death of a loved one, and there was hope expressed that that Lazarus would not die, and then there was hope after that as well that came in a way that probably was not expected. So the first part of the section of text that we're dealing with today is that transition from the previous sections, and then it will provide a context for the drama that is about to be presented. So let's consider this. And as we look at this transitional section, I would suggest that this involves a matter of a change of location that can make a difference in responses. And looking at verse 40 of John chapter 10, we read, "And he went away again beyond the Jordan to the place where John was baptizing at first, and there he stayed." Well, it's interesting, the reference to John the Baptizer here. And that was dealt with way back in John chapter 1 and a couple places in between. So it's kind of tying things in, but also gives us a placement of where things are going on here. So there is value in getting a break from rejection. The previous chapter had been talking about the rejection that Jesus was faced to the point of nearly being stoned. And sometimes we need a break. We can relate to that because there are many times we're dealing with things in life and we are ready for a break from the weight of those kinds of things. In this case, we see that the opposition against Jesus had been escalating back in John chapter 10 and the verses prior to this one. And so Jesus was about to be stoned again in that situation. The opposition of the Jewish leaders was intensifying. There had been the experience of sort of official rejection. They didn't want him. It was rather clear. They recognized his claims. They recognized what he was saying about himself, and they accused him of blasphemy in light of that, and they sought to kill him on the spot because it was acceptable in the thinking at that time that if someone was guilty of blasphemy, it was okay to do him in right then and there. So you want to be careful of blasphemy. Today, that doesn't seem to be as much of a concern. It seems to be happening all the time around us. So Jesus alluded to their evil intentions in the previous verses, and he escaped from what they were intending to do to him. Since it was not yet his time, he returned to a less threatening area of ministry to finish the work that he had been doing there. You recall last time we had talked about that he had gone to Perea and then had gone back to Jerusalem and for the celebration of the feast, and then had gone back to Perea, which was on the east side of the Jordan. And you'll see a map here, I think. Or did I just have the map up there? Anyway, it's just across from the city of Jericho and a little east and north of there. And Perea here is not to be confused with that restaurant on Juan Tabo where you can get Mexican food. Different Perea. So he had been there previously. He's now returned, and this place where he was associated with the baptizing work of John, the prophet. So one benefit of this location, of going there, was that the Jewish leaders had no authority to pursue him there. So it would be a very logical place to go. The town area where it was referenced that John had been baptizing in the New King James in John chapter 1, verses 28 and 29, refers to Bethabara, but in most of the other versions, including the UBS Greek text, the Nestle's text, and the majority text, refer to it as Bethany beyond the Jordan. So there's a textual variant here. The justification is kind of hard to say for sure. It may be that Bethabara is simply a variation on the name, which is what I suspect is the case. But this Bethany over here, this Bethabara or Bethany beyond the Jordan, is distinguished from the Bethany that's going to be referenced in chapter 11 where Lazarus and his sisters lived. So when we see that, we need to recognize that there is a difference there, if you're going to be looking at those particular details. But the other thing that we need to recognize is the exact location of this Bethany beyond the Jordan is unknown. We don't know exactly where it was. We only know approximately. But we do know that the responses there in that area were more positive than what he had experienced when he was in Jerusalem previously. So looking at verses 41 and 42... in the last section of John chapter 10, we read, "Then many came to him and said, 'John performed no sign, but all the things that John spoke about this man were true.'" In other words, John didn't have confirming signs like Jesus is doing in what they have seen, but the things that John said about him that he was predicting were true. "And many believed in him there." So that's obviously more positive than some of the other situations that Jesus had experienced in Jerusalem. So a change of venue may provide a more positive response. But sometimes it's helpful for us to keep that in mind. We may be dealing with a particular context and find that we're running up against a brick wall, and sometimes we just need to modify the location or the context just a little bit and see if we get more response when wanting to communicate what we know of Christ. The ministry of John the Baptizer continued to bear fruit. So he had had impact in this area, and his impact was continuing. Now, John had probably been killed by this time by Herod already, but his predictions with regard to the Messiah had been positively received. That's what this text is telling us, and that there were many that were following him as a result. So their attitudes and the responses that were found in this region beyond the Jordan was much more positive than what had been experienced in Jerusalem. These people accepted the testimony of John as true. They have had that the statements that were made, but now they're seeing that this is very positive, and it seems to be coming becoming more legitimatized and validated. So they believed that the things that John was saying about the Messiah were true, even though John wasn't doing the authenticating signs, but Jesus was, and in the process of Jesus doing that, he was authenticating what John had said about him. So here we see those things that John had said about him are being validated. And that's an encouragement, which should remind us of the opportunity that we have to communicate things about Christ to others. And even if we don't see immediate response, often in time we do. And such was the case with John as well, that there was this lingering opportunity. So we should be encouraged in that regard, because our testimony regarding Christ and what he has done and what he's done in our lives can have lingering effects as well. And we probably have even greater opportunity for influence today, because we have, for one thing, we have fuller revelation than what John had at that time, and we have more means of communicating it, because we have greater transportation opportunities, we have greater communication opportunities in a variety of different ways. So we should certainly take advantage of that and recognize the value that that can have. We've also noted that a major theme of John's gospel is to present Jesus as the Son of God and ultimately as the promised Messiah. And this is a validation of that here as well. There was a public presentation here, and also opportunity for his disciples to grow in their response and their understanding and their appreciation for what has been done. And it's, I think it's helpful for us to keep in mind, when we see people respond to Christ, it's an encouragement to us. And it ought to be. And we ought to take that as being a positive thing. Therefore, we ought to try to see it happen as much as we have a part in it, to let people know of the provision that Christ has. So then, coming to the next section here, looking at John chapter 11, verses 1 and 2, we see there's an awareness of a sick friend, and that can bring different responses. And here we read, "Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick." Now it's interesting to see what is pointed out here as far as the details. The context and character are first presented as a matter of fact. They're just sort of factual things that are stated. We are aware that this chapter presents the seventh of the authenticating signs in John's gospel, and we've noted that there are these various signs that have the effect of authenticating his work, and there are many dialogues that come as a result of those particular signs. We recall that Jesus had previously identified himself in this book as the water of life, as the bread of life, as the light of life. But now he's going to be presenting himself as the resurrection and the life. And it's probably one of the more powerful revelations of his true identity that he's going to be giving. And even though perhaps the people at that time didn't understand the significance of that, they would in due time. And so this communicated something of his authority over mankind's greatest and last enemy, that is death. Now, there are some who, when they look at the Gospel of John, they see there being eight signs in the book, because they consider Jesus' resurrection being another of the authenticating signs. But that's really kind of a different category of what's there. The other things are leading up to it in preparation for a recognition of that ultimate resurrection of himself. So I would see there's a sense in which you could argue that that would be a sign, but it's really the ultimate that the other signs are leading up to and preparing for. John first presents the characters with minimal context. He shares their names, the location, and the basic problem. The issue was the sickness of Lazarus of Bethany, and you may or may not know that Bethany is about 2 miles east of Jerusalem, just under 2 miles. I remember having visited Bethany several years ago, early 90s, and on that occasion, what I remember about it is there was a boy there who was illustrating the use of a sling. I don't think his name was David. But I was there to watch it, and I think that was interesting. But I particularly remember that being in Bethany, in perhaps a vicinity of where they think Lazarus and his family may have lived. And so he is identified in relation to his sisters, because they've had more press in the Gospels than what Lazarus has. Which is kind of interesting. His sisters are mentioned by the other gospel writers, Matthew 26, 6 to 12, Mark 14, 3 to 9, Luke 10, 38 to 42, but Lazarus is only mentioned here. Now, there is another Lazarus that's mentioned in in Luke chapter 16, but that is in a parable, as I would understand it, and is not the same individual. So Mary is identified as the more well-known person, and she's identified as sister to Martha and to Lazarus. And her most identified act is also pointed out in chapter 12 of John, and that was the act of anointing Jesus. And it was something that Jesus said she would be remembered for wherever the gospel went. And I think part of why John brings that up here is because when John is writing, it was many years after the other gospel writers, and so others who may have been aware of some of these details may have already heard of her in light of that. So I suggest probably there was an element of common knowledge of who she was, and that's why she was the one that was most recognized here in this case. Looking at verses 3 through 5 of John chapter 11, we read, "Therefore, the sisters went to him, saying, 'Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick.' When Jesus heard that, he said, 'This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it.' Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus." Now, whereas the previous verses identified in a more factual way, this is dealing with a more personal way. And so the characters here are identified with personal significance. There was a connection that is important. The concerned sisters sent an urgent request to Jesus. And this would seem to suggest that there was a way to know where Jesus was and a way to get word to him. How might that have been? We know something about the travel time in those days would have been a bit longer than what we're used to, even though the distance isn't all that great. For instance, the travel between Jerusalem and Jericho was fairly treacherous. It was more mountains, very rugged and very desolate between Jerusalem and Jericho. And it would be about 40 minutes of driving to Jericho from Bethany by car, which they didn't have. So you can imagine it's going to be a little longer. And then it's about an hour and a half to Beit Shan, which is on the west side of the Jordan, about three-quarters of the way up to the Sea of Galilee, if that gives you a little bit of an idea. So just to give the an upper or lower time frame, so the area that we're talking about is down as low as near Jericho, up as high as perhaps maybe as far as Beit Shan, closer to the Sea of Galilee, but not quite up that far. But we're also aware people have a way of communicating, and they certainly did at that point as well. They were still able to get word out. I don't know if they had a Pony Express or a camel train or whatever it might have been, but there would have been some ways. But I suspect that Jesus would have visited with them when he was in Jerusalem prior to his going to the area of Perea before, and he may have told them when he left where he was going, so they would have had some idea of where he might be and how to get a hold of him. So I suggest that that's probably the case, but that is, again, pure speculation on my part. The message sent played on an established relationship. So it was assumed there was a relationship here. And so the message began with a reference of respect, using the term Lord, but that would have been like Sir or Mister. It can be stronger than that, but the context is going to tell you whether it is. And they appealed to Jesus because of the friendship that he had with them and with Lazarus. And then they used the word for love here. It was phileo, brotherly love. Later they're going to use agapao, which is the slightly stronger word. But they indicated an expectation that Jesus could come and heal their sick brother. That was sort of just, it's not stated, but it's kind of understood. Come to us because we don't have any other recourse, but you are the one. So otherwise, why go to the lengths that they went to contact him when it was this distance, this complexity, this challenge as far as communication? So they took advantage of that. The response of Jesus was to put things in perspective. He has a way of doing that. That seems to be his common modus operandi, and we'll see that again in this passage as well. So Jesus spoke of the situation as if he knew about it already, because he did. He indicated that this sickness or state of incapacity was of temporary significance. So while Lazarus would suffer very real death and even decay, it would not last or be permanent at this time. And it indicates that Jesus had an awareness of the entire scenario already, and it says a lot about him as being something more than just a common human being. He was that, but he was more than that. So again, Jesus refers to God's glory and his relationship to it. He points out that this event would bring glory to God. In the process, he would be glorified and should be recognized as the Son of God, who he in fact is, which is what the whole Gospel of John is communicating all the way through. So the reference to glory in John's Gospel also has kind of the emphasis on self-revelation, more so than just praise that comes from men. It's a revealing kind of thing. In other words, Jesus would be glorified by being properly recognized for who he was as the Son of God. And there are several places in John's Gospel where that is indicated. And it's noteworthy that this passage communicates that someone becoming ill or dying does not mean that they are unloved by Jesus. Because this was someone that Jesus loved, and he died. Now, how can that be? Why would that be the case? This was someone that was very close to Jesus, someone that he knew on a very close personal level. He became ill, and he died, and the implication of the passage is that he could have gone right away when he was contacted and potentially heal him. Now, it doesn't say for sure that that would have been the case, but it seems to suggest that that might be it, at least in the minds of us as a possible way of thinking of it. But the idea that someone close to Jesus here contradicts the faulty view that the sickness of a believer indicates the Lord's displeasure with them. Because that's not what this is indicating. Even a close friend of Jesus got sick and died. And Jesus let it happen. So should we conclude that God's love is somehow evaluated on a temporal, conditional, or circumstantial basis? Lazarus didn't get sick and die because of something he did or did not do. It's because he's living in a fallen world, and sickness happens to people, even people that Jesus loved, in order, in this context, that his glory might be manifest so that people can see him for who he is. So it's just recognizing it's part of the human condition, and it gave opportunity for God's glory to be displayed, particularly through Christ, in this particular situation. But it also, the text also very specifically communicates something of the legitimate love that Jesus had for this family. Now, just try to imagine what it would have been like to be Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, and have that kind of relationship with Jesus. Did they realize the significance of that on a personal level? I suspect they might have to some degree. And after the events of this chapter, I think they did to a greater degree. It's like, wow, this is incredible. Now just imagine Jesus coming to your house to have lunch or dinner or breakfast. I mean, wow, that's amazing. But he knew this family personally and had concern for them, and that's what's expressed here. And it's telling us that because of what's going to happen next. And the love that's expressed here is using the strongest form of the word for love, which I think is also significant. And we know that Jesus, of course, would have had the purest form of love anyway. And so that would have been legitimate. But it's a reminder of the need for us to have love for one another as well, as Christ did. So then we come to the timing of one's response can be a lesson in itself. So when he had heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. You'd think there's got to be some good reason for that. Then after this, he said to the disciples, "Let's go to Judea again." That is after the 2 days. The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and are you going there again?" You know, as in, what are you thinking? Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world." What is the light of this world? "But if one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him." We want to think about what does he mean by that. So some situations bring out competing concerns. So we see some of that here. The timing of the trip to Judea was intentional. The M sisters, I like the sound of that, the M sisters, Mary and Martha. It's got a nice ring to it. I think they could start a singing group or something. They had already communicated their urgent concern for their sick brother, Lazarus. The concern of Jesus for this family has already been stated. John communicates that for us. It was also noted that he loved these three individuals. So this confirmation of his love for this family was to indicate that his delay in coming was not out of disinterest. It wasn't that he didn't really care. He did. But it was for a divine purpose. There was something more that's coming that needs to be recognized and anticipated. So it indicates that his delay in moving toward Jerusalem was entirely self-determined. And what was going to be coming when he went there for his own death and his resurrection, that was intentional as well. So what we may learn from this is that when God makes us wait, It may be for some divine purpose. And that may include some future blessing that we may not anticipate. So, I don't know about you, but I don't like to wait. I do what I can to avoid having to wait, or if I have to wait, I want to have something productive to do in the meanwhile. But just to wait is no fun. And yet, God has us wait at times, and He left Mary and Martha to wait a couple extra days, and then the travel time before He would come there, which ended up being 4 days after the death, ultimately, of Lazarus. The stated intention to return to Judea was met with serious concern for safety by the disciples. So when Jesus expressed His desire to return to Judea to minister to the needs of His friends, the disciples were just a little bit on edge. It had only been just a few months earlier that they had been in Jerusalem, and they were seriously concerned for another occasion of being threatened with stoning, if not worse, which they weren't too far off, because something more significant was going to be coming in the future. But they also didn't necessarily appreciate that what Christ was doing was intended for a greater purpose. And that greater purpose included the resurrection of Lazarus, but also the anticipation of His own death, burial, and resurrection that would be coming. So the disciples had concerns that we probably can relate to. Really? You're going to go back to the same place where you were just about done in? Why would you do that? That's risky. We're not supposed to be risky, are we? Well, there are some who don't mind a little bit of risk here and there, but some more than others. So the response of Jesus was to give them insight and perspective. So we need to think about the time frame reference here to the 12 hours. It needs some clarification for our Western minds, because the Jews and the Romans commonly regarded the total daylight hours as 12 and the nighttime hours as the other 12, which we understand, we can relate to. Depending on where you are, latitude and longitude-wise, all those factors can affect how much daylight you have in a given time, but generally we can relate to that picture. So literally Jesus was referring to the daylight hours, but metaphorically the daylight hours represented being in the Father's will. And the point was that Jesus was safe as long as He did the Father's will. This is what He was intending for Him to do. For the disciples, as long as they continued to follow Jesus, the light of the world, they would not stumble. They would be safe in that light as well. And they would be recognizing the divine illumination and the authorization that is in view here. And it was in opposition to the realm of darkness or evil that would be dangerous. So the idea is, as long as you're walking in the light of the revelation that you have from God, you are in a safe place. But you get out of that and you are not necessarily in a safe place. You may be reminded of 1 John chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. It says, if we say that we have fellowship with Him and walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. But if we walk in the light as He is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus Christ cleanses us from all sin. So there is more of an emphasis on that walking in the light by the same author, John, only in the epistles. So Jesus was expressing concern that His disciples understood the need and value of living within the Father's will as Jesus was. That's the picture that is being communicated here. And so in as much as they did so, they had nothing ultimately to fear, since their greatest concern should be to trust and obey God and not fear man. And all we have to think about is, what are the things that we fear the most? in our daily routine? Well, there are a lot of things that we can be concerned about. One of the fears that people have is getting a virus. That's been a bit on people's minds of late. But there are other things as well. We fear the political decisions and responses of those around us. But ultimately, do we have anything to fear if we know God through Christ and follow Him? So while we may have competing concerns, we need to keep things in perspective and have a proper divine outlook as Jesus had, as best we can, in whatever context we're dealing with. Then, looking at verses 11 through 16, these things he said, and after that he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up." Then his disciples said, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get well." However, Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought he was talking about taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus said to them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him." Then Thomas, who is called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, now how I read this is going to determine how you think it's understood. "Let us go that we may die with him." Or is it, "Let us go that we may die with him"? How do you understand it? That's a good question. Hopefully we can figure it out. So this situation provided opportunity to evaluate concerns. Jesus indicated his concerns to minister to Lazarus. He used terminology that could be misunderstood because he was speaking in a more of a metaphorical type of way. He intended to explain why he needed to go to Judea. He used the metaphor of sleep to refer to death. But that wasn't that unusual because it was used in the Old Testament frequently. And so its reference to so-and-so slept with his fathers. Jesus spoke of death as sleep at other times, like Mark chapter 5, verse 39. So the metaphor of sleep as death should have been recognized and would have been easier to grasp than the reference to waking up. I'm going to go wake him up. That's what threw him off. I think they would have gotten the sleep part if he hadn't referenced the waking up. But this waking up would have been alluded to in Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, which says, "And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt." But they could have picked up on that, theoretically, but they again were pretty in tune to what was going on at the time. Because normally people thought of those who fell asleep in death as staying asleep in death. And that's what we normally think of as well. So his disciples did not recognize the seriousness of the situation. And so their confusion was understandable. They thought he was talking about normal sleep. And if someone's sick, they often sleep more. And that's a good thing because it's restorative. But John here is indicating that Jesus was talking about death, because John is writing after the fact and he's communicating to his audience that was many years after these particular events. And so he was able to give commentary that gave some elucidation in the process. But the disciples thought that Lazarus was just resting in normal sleep. The New Testament writers also referred to believers who had died as having fallen asleep in anticipation of the future resurrection, which was in view because they had more revelation by that time. So Acts 7:60 says, "Then he," that's referring to Stephen, "fell down and cried out with a loud voice, 'Lord, do not charge them with this sin.' And When he said this, he fell asleep. Well, what happened? He died. He was stoned to death. 1 Corinthians 15:6 says, after that he was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to this day, to the present, but some have fallen asleep. Or verse 20 of 1 Corinthians 15, but now Christ is risen from the dead and has become the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. 1 Corinthians 15:51, behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall be changed. That's the common nursery verse. Isn't that posted in all the nurseries? We shall not all sleep, but we shall be changed. Just thought you might want to know that. In light of the shower that we just had, you know, that makes good sense. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Then 1 Corinthians 4:13 to 15 says, but I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will raise, will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep. So, that terminology was familiar. It was recognized more so later, probably looking back to the reference that Jesus had to it, building on what had been communicated in the Old Testament. So it was not something that was difficult to understand, except for the part about waking up. But again, Daniel chapter 12, verse 2 indicates something there. So it was a common metaphor, which, you know, they recognize we use the same terminology sometimes. But it was also, it needs to be pointed out here that Jesus was not talking about soul sleep. And that should be clear from Luke 16:19-31, where the parable of the rich man and Lazarus is given. The doctrine of soul sleep holds that at death the soul, specifically the immaterial part of man, becomes unconscious until the resurrection of the body. But the parable of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16 shows that people are conscious after death and before their resurrection. So that would seem to nullify that kind of thinking, though some people do think of it in that regard. But Jesus here was not talking about Lazarus being asleep in rest, but that he was actually dead, and he comes right out and says that. In other words, it was more serious than just being sick. He was now dead, and it was not going to come and wake him up from a nap, but he's going to bring him back to life. We often use the word resurrection, and that's not completely illegitimate, but more technically would be a resuscitation, because when we think about the resurrection of Christ and we think about the resurrection that we are going to experience, it's more than just a resuscitation. So that's something to keep in mind. So Jesus was very clear. Lazarus is dead. They had a sense of concern, perhaps, that that was the case. And then they may have been wondering, well, why are we going back there if he's dead? There's nothing we can do other than to go to the funeral. So I assume that might have been going on in their minds. But Jesus was having in mind a much bigger miracle, and one that they could have been perhaps more open to, but would become more open to in the very near future. So there were different concerns that were expressed and indicated here. So then we come to the last section here. Thomas illustrates the cynical nature of human thinking. This is actually the first reference to Thomas saying something in the Gospels. And he's recognized as one of the 12 in several different texts. He's identified here as the one who's called the twin. In Hebrew and Aramaic, his name means the twin or twin. The Greek equivalent is Didymus. It also means twin. We don't know who his sibling was, whether it was a boy or a girl. The meaning of the statement of Thomas has been understood differently by different people. When you read the commentaries, you come up with different responses. Some think it's one emphasis that I noted earlier. Others think it's the other. But what is there in the context to give us some insight? Is it that he was providing a statement of courage? Let's go with him and die. Or was he being a classic cynic? Let's go die with him. Because it can be read either way. But is there anything in the context to give some insight? Well, remember that the emphasis was on safety back in verse 8. There was a very real anticipation of doom and harm awaiting them in Judea. So given that context, they were already perhaps thinking of concern in that way. It was perhaps also an ironic, prophetic anticipation of what was going to happen to them. They would all be martyred, except for maybe John. And he was sent to an island. The statement was directed to the disciples. That should be significant. It wasn't addressed to Jesus. It was addressed to his fellow disciples. And so I think it was sort of an aside. He might have been less inclined to state it to Jesus. And then there's the question of who is the antecedent to the hymn? Let's go die with him. Is it to go die with Lazarus, who they had just heard was dead, or was it to go die with Jesus because he's going to where he had some serious trouble with the Jews before? And I would couple this statement here with what was given in John chapter 20, verse 25, and suggest that Thomas's skepticism may give us an indication of the kind of thinking that Thomas tended to have. So I think there's more reason to think that this was cynicism rather than courage that was being communicated. And the Bible commentaries vary on this. I would note that Thomas Constable thinks it's a sign of courage, but I think that's because his name is Thomas. So I don't agree with him on that. But there are other commentaries that, Pink and Merrill, that think it's cynicism, and I think that's the best way to take it. And there's no shortage of cynicism in our world today in many different contexts. There may be a time for some cynicism, but it can be a serious attitude and disposition problem as well. And I think it's indicating something of that nature in this passage. Because we can get caught in the trap of cynicism. But we shouldn't as believers, because we know what the ultimate outcome of things in this life are going to be. We have the completed prophetic word. We know what's going to happen. So we don't have to be cynical. Though sometimes it's hard not to be, just a bit cynical, but we need to catch ourselves and be careful not to let that push us into a negativity that is detrimental. So while there's a lot in this world that could lead us to cynicism, we should be ultimately beyond that. Our attitude is always a critical part of life that we need to have control over by the Spirit's enablement. And we need to concern ourselves with that which is positive. And I appreciate the words of Philippians chapter 4, verse 8, that we probably are quite familiar with. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, and if there is anything praiseworthy, be cynical about these things. Wait, that's not what it says. It says meditate on these. Focus on the positive, not on the negative. There's plenty of negative stuff out there. Just be careful not to let that pull us into that kind of mentality. So what concerns do we have at present? We certainly have concerns about a lot of different things. There is a concern when there is a loved one that dies that we have to address and deal with. And that's going to be dealt with more in the next section that we're going to be looking at and the responses to it. But are we concerned about the right things? Are we focused on the right things? Are we dwelling on things that lead us to cynicism, or are we dwelling on those things that lead us to the hope that we have in Christ in the present and in the future? We need to look beyond the circumstances to Christ. That's a good reminder.